Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, we are all sharing a eulogy for our favorite beleaguered mobile vendor. That would be LG. The company announced its exit from the mobile game this week. And I've assembled a crack team of LG fans, the few left in the world, to go through the highs and lows of this interesting last couple decades. We'll also talk about Google's entry into the Silicon game with Whitechapel and what that could mean for the next Pixels. We'll talk about Google I.O. because that's a thing again this year. And the fact that Google has beaten Oracle, finally, another 10-year quest in court. This was a Supreme Court decision that I don't think anybody was surprised about, but it has its benefits and its drawbacks depending on where you stand. And then finally, we'll go through a couple of quick reviews. We'll talk about the new Galaxy A phones. And if we have time, we will make fun of Hayato because that's what we like to do. No, I'm joking. But talking about the gentleman himself, Hayato Huseman, welcome back. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. Weather's finally picking up, so I'm happy.
Okay, I'm glad to hear it. And even though you're in Indianapolis...
For a little bit longer.
For now. And also welcoming back to the show, Michael Fisher, Mr. Mobile himself. How are you, dude? Welcome back.
Daniel Bader, I'm well. Thank you for having me back. As usual, I have mixed feelings about the whole affair because, as you know, I listen to the show every week, and with the exception of weeks where I'm a guest. So I'm sad to be missing the show this week, but I hope it's good for everybody else.
I hope so, too. No pressure on your part, then, to perform.
Yeah, jeez.
There are other great Android podcasts. Our friends at All About Android, we love to shout them out. They're the OG. They also celebrated 10 years of All About Android this past week. I listened to that show, so congratulations to them. And our friend Miriam Jouar, who hosts a weekly show, the Mobile Tech Podcast.
Indeed.
Which is another show that you guested recently. So I think people should listen to those. I like shouting out competitor/friend shows right at the beginning because, you know, it gives people the opportunity if they don't like the intro to just go and listen to those.
They're like, oh, those shows sound way better. I got to click
those
away.
Those intros are way less convoluted than this one. And welcoming to the show for the first time, our news editor, Android Central's newest employee, Derek Lee. How are you, dude?
Doing all right. It's a little overcast here in Seattle, but... What's new?
What is new, exactly? Andrew Martinick would come on the show every week and just sound exactly as dour as you do about the weather.
Hey, so. I moved here because I love this weather, so I'm actually enjoying it.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry to hear that. So you're on somewhat because you haven't been on the show, but also because you are a massive LG stan. You've been touting awaiting this the death of LG with bated breath for quite a few months. Internally, we've been talking about it, but also you just are a big LG fan. You've been using a lot of those phones. So I guess we'll start there, right? This was not an unexpected announcement. Michael, you put out a video I think yesterday talking about the last, you know, couple decades. You have a lot of LG phones in a box that you did. Question, inside baseball, mm-hmm. Did you put them in a box in order to film them being taken out of the box, or were they already in said box when you did the filming?
I created the box. That's what we call a prop in the biz.
Okay.
Created a box just for the video. But no, it's my When Phones Were Fun closet is so overflowing that it needs organization anyway, so I was going to do that eventually anyway. But yeah, I had been collecting LG phones for that series. And when we first started hearing whispers, probably about a month ago now, that LG was shopping that mobile unit around, I was like, you know, maybe I should just start getting more LG units. So I just kind of went a little overboard on eBay and got the ones that I thought were important to me.
Okay, so let's actually start there because, you know, everybody should go watch the video, but we have a little bit more time to talk about our favorites on this show. Walk us through your relationship with LG Mobile dating back to, you know, the mid 2000s and their feature phones.
Yeah.
And I want to leave leave everybody with like that impression of you are really going to miss the LG Wing for its potential. And coming all the way back to 2005, 2006, 2007, when LG was pure potential and actually making waves in the mobile phone space.
You know, even earlier than that, I had the good fortune of being a Sprint customer as early as 2001.
I'm so sorry.
And well, you know, there were definitely compromises, right? But one of the good parts about being a Sprint customer, besides the fact that they didn't check 18-year-olds' credit in 2001, was that they carried some of the hottest phones we got in the U.S. Sprint always had this very hot handset relationship thing. I don't know what they did, but they always got the cooler phones for years. So my first phone was a Samsung, but my second one was built by LG, and it wasn't even branded LG yet. I mean, this was when LG was a white label manufacturer for in the mobile space, at least. And they made a phone called the TouchPoint 1100, which is not important. I'm not going to go through it. It was a little tiny clamshell, but it was, even back then, you had these seeds of distinctiveness. It was the smallest clamshell available at the time. It was almost impossibly small. I remember a high school friend of mine coming up to my table at Applebee's when I was back from college and saying something like, oh my God, is that your phone? I can poop bigger than that. And, you know, it was really distinctive. And then as the years went on, LG never did put out a boring phone, at least in the high end, for the next decade. I mean, you know, you had the 3G rollouts with all the color screens coming to thing, and they kept leaning into that very small, very light, very eye-catching with cool colorways, interesting things. And then as messaging phones started happening, they just came in and just absolutely dominated that space for a while. When, you know, people were like, well, I'm not a businessman. I don't need a BlackBerry. It's 2006. It's 2007. What are you talking about? But I do like texting. So all these QWERTY phones started coming out with the big old keyboards, and LG just owned that space on every carrier for a while. And it really wasn't until we, you know, got into the beginning of the Android phase that I took my foot off the gas there. They weren't as compelling to me for a little while. And then I got into this business and started reviewing them. But I think that's when probably Derek or Hayato can pick up on what LG was doing in those early days of Android while I was busy carrying my HTC Evo 4G around town.
Yeah, getting weighed down by those massive early LTE phones from
IMAX,
HTC. Yeah, that's right. On Sprint. I'll throw the same to you, Hayato. What's your like earliest LG smartphone or phone memory?
I mean, my first ever cell phone when I was, I don't know, 13, 14 was this LG like little clamshell flip phone. But as far as smartphones go, my first one, I think, was actually sent to me by this guy, Michael, back when we were working together at Pocket Now.
What?
You sent me the Sprint version of the LG G Flex 2.
I just grabbed that video. I just stole a bunch of B-roll from that video.
Oh, man. That thing was fun.
Yes.
That was a lot of fun.
It was.
I loved the super striking, like, really vibrant red. And, I mean, like, just, I think one of my first assignments at Pocket Now as, like, as an actual employee was... You sent me this, and either you or Tony was just like, hey, it's got a self-healing back. You need to test that. And so they like, I just had to make a video of just beating the hell out of this thing, like throwing it in my pocket with keys. And like, I threw it out of my car. I took a knife to it. I did all sorts of stuff. It was terrible, and it was a lot of fun. And that was, I think, my first like really lasting memory of an LG smartphone. And then, you know, throughout the years, I got to sort of go to more briefings and film different LG phones and all of their wacky different designs. I mean, one of my favorite clips I've ever shot for AC was with Daniel at the G8 briefing. Just this ridiculous shot of him trying to get this whole gesture thing working with his hand, and it just what a
I'm
fun
never
going to
live
was.
Down that GIF. It's
what a that's my favorite footage that exists of you, Dan.
Michael's put that in half a dozen videos. No context.
So true.
Just me with the claw.
The claw.
It's terrible.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that the Flex 2 had a self-healing back, because the narrative, the overarching narrative about that phone was just that it's its performance was so bad and that it overheated because of the Snapdragon 810.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the software was such garbage. And it was just the only phone that year, aside, like, even the, what was the LG G phone of that year? It was the G4?
It must have been the G3 or G4, right?
Because that was the year of the Snapdragon 805-810 dichotomy, when Samsung put an Exynos chip inside of its phones that year because it couldn't put a Qualcomm chip because they were overheating. So that must have been the Note 5. So yeah, 2014. So that was the G3. Yeah, I guess that's true. Anyway, Derek, what's your earliest memory that sticks out to you about LG phones?
I mean, the first phone I ever wanted was an LG flip phone, but I didn't get it. I got some Kyocera phone with Virgin Mobile. I feel like my relationship with LG is a little complicated in the beginning, because for a long time I was a huge Nokia fan, which is, I mean, another company that kind of died. So, I mean, I just have bad luck with this, apparently. but I didn't start getting into LG phone, like smartphones, until probably the G4. I think that was the first one that I had. And I loved it. I mean, I know I had, like, you know, apparently I had like the boot loop issues. I never had that problem, so I wasn't as jaded as everyone else, I feel like. Especially moving into the G5, where things started getting interesting. I don't know. I feel like, you know, starting with, I think, the V10, actually, like, LG was always that company that I love to show off, because they were always just doing weird things. You know, the V10 with the second screen, the G5 with its weird modular thing that just didn't really work out too well for them. And then even with the G6, I mean, the G6 was a little plain, but, like, you know, that kind of started the whole, like, aspect ratio thing that, you know, pretty much all smartphones are doing now. And also, you know, the dual cameras, that was something I love to show off on the G5. Just, you know, anyone I could, you know, I'm just like, hey, you know, look at my phone, look what I can do. And not only that, but I can, you know, I can take out the battery, you know, I can add, you know, different modules. Like, it's so cool. Like, LG was just always that company that I love to show off, you know, because they were just always doing weird things. And I really appreciated that about them.
Yeah.
I'd like that G4 thing, to jump in, Bader, like I still remember the vibe of LG at that time. That was such an interesting time to cover LG stuff, because the G4 event in New York City, I remember going, and I was not on the list for a review unit or something like that. And I'm at the event, and I'm really bummed out by this, because LG is, at the time, coming off this amazing success of the G2, which was a big popular favorite, and then the G3, which was, you know, which I don't know if it sold as well, but it certainly got a lot more press. But the G4 was just like, we all felt it was coming to a head finally. We all felt like, oh, well, this is the one. And then when the T-Mobile, I think, got me a unit that day, and I was so elated that I could kind of participate in this first wave of generating impressions about this device. And man, you know, at every turn, it impressed me. I mean, I think that's the last time that happened, with the possible exception, Derek, you're right, of the G6, which was a great phone. At every turn, it was like, wow, this is comfortable. This is performant. The camera's way better than I thought it was going to be. It has interesting features, and it has a leather back if you get it from one carrier. Like, I genuinely, genuinely missed that particular period where LG was not on top, but had a lot of space to play and had a lot of great ideas and was implementing them fairly well. Of course, nobody could have known about those solder problems that caused that boot looping thing, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's less about, I mean, I don't want to take the onus off LG there, because obviously it was the company's fault.
Oh yeah.
But that was less about LG Mobile as a division, as it was just about LG Electronics manufacturing defects and the fact that the process of building those phones was inherently flawed. there are so many different parts of a company that goes into building a phone, and you know, LG being its own manufacturer, that was the issue. But like, you shouldn't. I worry that like the reputation of the phones themselves are too sullied by the fact that the manufacturer, is that fair? Am I giving it too much credit? But like it really did ruin the phone's reputations, even though for people that didn't experience the boot loop problems, they were, as Derek said, like pretty great devices during that period.
I think if it had been limited to one of the product lines, it would have been a lot easier mm-hmm. for LG to move past that. But it was just so many phones.
Right. Yeah, it was.
The V10, I've heard of it on the V20, right. The G4, the G Flex 2 even had it, right?
The like, Nexus 5X as well.
Right.
Yeah. And then I think stopped at the G6.
Yeah. Yeah, because that was when they sort of reevaluated their whole strategy and came out with the, we're just going to be a hard, like a straight and narrow phone manufacturer. We're not going to be experimenting anymore. We're just going to focus on the fundamentals and regaining your trust. And that that led into like the boring years.
Yeah, but you know, that also gave us the V30, which I thought was a great phone as well.
Kind of like a refined
G6. And I, you know, that was the longest LG phone that I own. You know, I usually get a phone like every year, but I had that phone for like almost 2 years, I think. But yeah, Michael, you're right. Like, I think because it spans so many different, like, you know, phones, the whole boot looping issue, that really, you know, just messed things up for LG. Because I mean, Samsung, you know, they had their, you know, their exploding Note, what was it, 5?
7, Note 7.
Yeah. And, you know, it was just really that phone. And they, you know, they bounced back from that. But LG, you know, I feel like they were just so tarnished by the boot looping problem. And, you know, me having previously worked for AT&T, you know, whenever I try to, you know, sell anyone on an LG phone, you know, especially because I had one, you know, and I would show it off to them, they're just like, no, because, you know, I've had bad experiences with them. And it was really unfortunate.
Yeah, that's kind of the bummer, right? Because it combines with other issues that LG was facing that began to get increasingly more attention in the media, which was their lack of software updates or the general kind of software was the software was never much good, and every time they would revamp it, it was like it still isn't a very pretty UI, is it? You know, and it was like that combined with the boot looping thing and with their kind of reputation for not having great QA, great support. I mean, that really does erode a brand over time. I think we certainly shouldn't give LG a pass on that. Although I am guilty of that whenever a phone manufacturer leaves the space or has a big disaster, I'm like, oh God, let's just remember all the good times. But it's important to consider why the company is at its current state, you know?
Of course. Yeah. And I want to just go back to the early days of the decade of last decade and remember that the G series didn't actually come to fruition until 2012, and that the earliest LG Android phones were the Optimus phones, the Optimus 1, the Optimus 2, the Optimus 2X.
Optimus G.
Right, and then the Optimus G was the one that eventually became then the Optimus G was the first G phone, and then it just became the G2. But the Optimus G was not a very forward thinking device. It was basically a Samsung Galaxy clone, which itself was an iPhone clone. There was very little innovation, and it took until the G2 for LG to kind of find its path. And really focus on hardware on big screens, right? That culminated in the G3 having the first QHD display, a massive 5.5-inch display on a relatively compact form factor. The G4 was a beautiful iteration on the G3, right? With those custom leather backs that you could, you know, you could take on and off and change according to your mood. I thought the G4 was, for its faults on the software side, a massive improvement over the G3 in a lot of meaningful ways.
Yeah, agree.
And it just, I have a G4, a couple of them actually in my drawer, and I take them out every once in a while and just marvel at how beautiful they were as objects and how far we've come since then in the 7 or 8 years since they were released.
Well, the G4 kind of built on that experimentation we were talking about with the G-Flex, right? Because it had a curved chassis and they walked it back. They didn't have to do the, was the display curved as well, or was it just the glass over it?
I think the display was not curved.
I don't think
the display was curved, but I was looking at like earlier photos I took of the phone and there was definitely a curve to it.
Yeah, it's just that the ergonomics, the fit and finish of that model was so great. And it was so nice to see LG doing what Samsung did for a long time too, which was having this out there experimental line and this line for the normies. And then every generation, the normal phone would kind of pull in the things they could from the moonshot phone. And the G4 was really the culmination of that for me. I agree, Bader.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. It's all coming back. When you start thinking about it, the G4 and the G-Flex 2, so that was the same year, Snapdragon 808, that's what it was. So that 808 was a slightly upgraded version of the 805, I believe, which itself was a relatively minor update over the 801. The 808 was sort of an 810 with only two of the high performance cores, if I'm not mistaken. So
it was a six core, right?
It wasn't quite as heavy on battery. And then the G Flex 2 obviously had the proper A10 in it with all that entailed. But yeah, I mean, I really have very positive memories about the G4, and I thought that was sort of the height of phone customization, and they let you kind of do as much as you wanted with those devices. The silhouette on that thing today still is pretty great. Let's talk a little bit about the V series. Derek, you brought up the V10 as being the first phone with kind of a dual screen. That legacy persists, I think, and really, you know, I'm not going to say that the V10 was the progenitor of folding phones. Obviously, it's a pretty big leap to tiny little ticker display on the top all the way to we now have phones that fold and offer two distinct displays. But you can see where the genesis of that idea that you have a primary display and a secondary display and how they work in harmony. And Michael, I would love you to get, you know, a little bit nerdy with me and talk about your recollections of the V series, because I didn't have it here in Canada. It was a US only line for a long time. I never actually saw the V10 until we were in Atlanta at the first MonaCon, and our colleague Chris Parsons was using it, and that's because he loved it so much.
It's funny because I think I will have to defer to the other gents, because the V10, I only went hands-on with it. I only covered it in a hands-on capacity, I think. I don't think I reviewed it. And the V20, due to a clerical error, I never got a unit. Mm. And then I held a grudge for a while, and they were like, oh my God, we're so sorry. So yeah, the V10 and V20, I almost missed out on entirely, but I am eager to hear how they performed out in the real world, because I remember holding that V10 and being like, holy crap, you guys did stainless steel rails and what feels like a kitchen dishwashing mat for the back. Like, this thing, it's just, you could bludgeon someone to death with it. And
yes.
I loved that. You know, what a refreshing change that was from the other, from the glossy normal stuff.
I think back then when the V10 came out, I was still working at T-Mobile in retail. And I remember like getting the display unit into the store and just messing with the hardware for the first time. I was like, this is one of the most interesting designs for a phone. Like, it really, I think, felt premium and like durable and solid in a way that most phones didn't back then. In a way that, I mean, I haven't held a V10 in years, but I imagine it still holds up now, because I'm just like remembering that super ruggedized rubbery backing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like, stainless steel is still like such a premium feature in phones, you know. Like, it was really, really cool hardware. And then of course it had like the manual video controls for, I think, the first time in a phone.
Yes, I think so too.
They were, I think, they were fairly rudimentary compared to what we've got now. But I mean, especially back then, and I think 2015, 2016, it was like, this is really, really impressive to have in just like a cell phone you just tuck in your pocket, you know. It's like practically DSLR type controls on that thing.
I remember the press events being so rewarding for the V-Series in particular, because LG was able to... LG kind of got nerdy with us, is my recollection at these things. There's a distinct moment at the V30 event where I think something we had been bugging them about for like two generations, and they had never put in the V10 or V20. And I believe there were three or four features like that. Like the V30 was such a kitchen sink phone in a lot of ways, and their lead engineer, or maybe the product manager who owned the V line, I'm sad that I don't remember his name, but he was like, he essentially gave us the rundown, and then he looked at me as I was looking at the phone, and he kind of let me look at it for a second, and then he goes, "You see, we listened."
Yeah.
I was like, God, you guys are the best.
They did that a lot.
I really loved that. Yeah.
Derek, did you get a chance to use the V10?
I did. And I believe I reviewed it too. I did enjoy that phone. I don't think I loved it, but like, I feel like it was one of the first phones to like have any sort of dual camera on it. It was on the front, so like it gave you, you know, those wide selfie shots, and they really hyped that up, because that was kind of like, you know, the beginning of the whole selfie craze. And so LG was like, all right, well, here, you can fit more people in your selfies. And I really, like, I took so many selfies with that phone.
Was that before HTC started doing that?
I don't quite remember. I want to say it was probably around the same time.
Okay.
HTC first did it on the 10, but that was a single camera, right?
Well, yeah.
HTC was doing it, but like it was like they were adding this, like it was like a depth sensor or something. Like it wasn't actually usable on the HTC phones. It was just
no. It was the front had a wide angle lens and a regular. So one was 80 degrees and one was 120. I'm currently reading CNET's V10 review. I think it was one of the first phones with a dual selfie camera. And it was also one of the first to have wide angle on the back as well.
Well, that was the G5, I believe, was one of the first to have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. G5 and V20, right?
Yeah.
Well, because the V10 only had one on the back.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. It had one on the back, not two.
But then the G5 came, I think, the following year, and they put two on the back and one on the front.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess we have to talk a little bit about the G5, because that was a bit of a disaster.
Derek just deflates.
There was just so much potential, and like, you know, and I own the G5. I actually won it at work, which was awesome. So I fortunately didn't have to pay for it. But
wow.
I won that and like the extra battery with the battery pack. So like, you know, and that was nice, because I would always have a charged up battery, you know, but of course you'd have to turn off the phone, you know, to, you know, flip out your, you know, whatever module you want to have. So obviously that was a huge design flaw for the G5. But I thought it was, you know, I thought it was a good phone, again, because, you know, it was one of the first to have the wide angle on the back. So I really played that up. And then LG kind of even had their lineup of accessories for it, like the 360 cam, the plug-in camera
VR
module.
Headset. The DAC.
Yeah, the DAC. Yeah, and that's when LG like really started focusing on the DAC too. You know, so the G5, it had so much potential, but yeah, execution just wasn't that great. And I'm sad that, like, you know, LG's accessory lines just kind of fell by the wayside after that.
Yeah, and I think that's where we started to see the kind of fragmentation really come into effect with LG on a per market basis, because depending on where you lived, not only could you maybe not even get the G5, but you couldn't get those friends, LG called them. All the accessories were friend, LG friends. And in the US, I think the B&O DAC/speaker thing just never arrived because it never got FCC certification. I think I remember Jerry saying something like there was RF leakage with it, so it couldn't get approved or something. I don't know. It's citation needed. But like the fact that you couldn't get all the accessories in all markets, and Derek, you're right about the having to power off the phone first to pull those modules, that sucked. But I think it only sucked in comparison to this really bad luck that LG had of Motorola releasing the Moto Z in the same year.
Yeah, and I was going to bring that up too, because you just pop, you know, a module on the back and you're good to go.
Right, Right. Like you, I will never forget Motorola just demoing that speaker, that JBL speaker. And they just were playing mm-hmm. Spotify on the Moto Z and it was kind of awesome. Crappy. Throw on that speaker and bam. So yeah, that really kind of instantly put LG in the grave in terms of the modular thing. Plus the fact that apparently that VR headset was not very good. I never used it.
I wanted that too. And I don't think it was available in the US, was it?
Again. Yeah. Which probably not.
Man, I was such a, not that anything has really changed, but I was such a pedantic like dick back then when the G5 came out.
I was going to say, what are you talking about? What's changed?
Back then I was like, okay, this phone is really cool. I like the idea of the G5. My big issue with it that like made me stop getting I just kind of lost interest in the phone was, even though you could like swap out all these little modular parts and kind of make it into whatever phone you wanted, my issue was that when you put any of these mods onto it, it wasn't like perfectly aligned with the rest of the body. So there was like mm-hmm, this little mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. It's a little sharp where the two parts connect. Yes. I was like, man, this sucks. This design's terrible.
After a while, that started giving out on my G5, and I had to keep my case on so that that part would stay on, so that my phone would stay on. Because it might the battery would just disconnect.
Jeez,
I could just imagine a bunch of G5 owners putting duct tape on the space between the camera, the body, and the camera, the battery. Like it did look terrible after a while. After you took it off a few times, it did not align. It was super janky. And I agree, like Michael, you mentioned this in your video, this was the year that the Moto Z line debuted, and it just felt like, obviously, magnets. Like, why wouldn't you think of freaking magnets?
How do they work?
It really just took the wind out of LG's sails from the first moment that Motorola announced the Moto Z in June. So I think the LG G5 debuted in April, and it had a couple of months of being the modular phone. And then Motorola had that big press event with Ashton Kutcher, if you recall, in Chicago, where he was it Chicago
we were there.
Or New York?
San Francisco. We were there. It was SF. It was Lenovo Tech World.
Oh, okay. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But I remember the event. I just don't remember which city it was. But and apparently Ashton Kutcher was in a really bad mood, and he like argued with somebody on the stage. I just thought funny.
Oh, remember, I couldn't believe it. I was like, man. I knew I was going to see Ashton. Damn those radio DJs from the early aughts who would make fun of his name. I cannot, to this day, I still keep calling him Ashton Krujna. Sorry. I knew I was going to see him, and I wasn't terribly excited, but I was like, yeah, that'll be pretty cool. And then he was on stage, like, he was giving the flattest reads ever. He was so pissed off. I don't know what happened there. Yeah. And I think that was the last time he appeared as an ambassador, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Was this worse than Michael Bay with Samsung?
I can't do this.
It wasn't Samsung. Wasn't it Qualcomm?
No, it was Samsung. It was for their TVs.
Okay.
Yeah. CES.
Yeah. There have been so many celebrity storm offs that I can't keep track, apparently.
But you're right. At that event, it was like, you'd slap on that stuff and you're like, okay, well, good job, Motorola, LG. See you next year, I guess. Better luck next time.
And then we did. We saw them with the G6, and this was sort of the era of, for lack of a better term, boring LG, right? Mm-hmm. We had the G6 was the first 18:9 phone. So it had a 2:1 aspect ratio, and everybody was like getting mad at us for saying 18:9. Why don't you just say it properly and call it 2:1?
Do some division.
Yeah. Do some math, asshole. It had dual rear cameras. It had wireless charging and IP68 water resistance, but only for a couple of models. Then they had the quad DAC, but only in Asia, right?
Oh,
you had to import the Asian version if you wanted the high quality DAC. Eventually that did come to all the rest of the G series phones, but this one didn't. It was a mess. They had a G6 Plus that launched later that year with the DAC and wireless charging, but it was an Amazon exclusive, I think. It just, they had a bunch of carrier deals that made it really difficult to get. LG stopped selling their phones unlocked. And then the next year, 2018, I believe Michael, you and I, we went to Korea for
the G7.
Yeah,
but I know you want to get there, but hold on a second. I'm sorry, because I want to say that I don't think the era of boring LG started with the G6. I think it started with the G7 because I still remember, yes, I remember holding the G6 and being like, you know, I wish this was more exotic. I wish they were being a little more, taking a little bit more of a risk. But at the time, I understood it. The G5 was a big failure. I mean, they lost like $240 million in that quarter, in that last quarter of whatever that year was. But it was such a course correction on so many other mm-hmm. fronts. Like the G5's wide-angle camera had a crappy sensor. Well, they fixed that. And they fixed, you know, it was the same resolution. And I still remember walking the streets of Barcelona taking photos with the G6 wide-angle with Alex Dobie and being like, dude, this is transformative. This is amazing. This has to be on every single phone now. And of course, that later became the truth. And the build, you know, how they brought that military, look, military standard A10G is like 800 pages long. That certification means nothing without a bunch of asterisks. But it was a very durable phone. I threw it around. It withstood a lot of stuff. The 2-to-1 made a lot of sense. The kind of slimmed bezels on the sides. Like, I loved that phone. And I think a lot of other people did too.
A lot of, like one thing, because a lot of phones at the time too were coming out with the water and dust resistance, and LG, you know, couldn't mm-hmm. because of the G5 and the V10 and the V20 because, you know, they had the removable battery. Well, you know, the G6 finally, you know, put that on one of their, mm-hmm. like they finally put it on one of their phones with the G6. And so that kind of fixed right. that too.
Amen.
So, yeah. I mean, the G6 was definitely a course correction, and then the V30 was, you know, just a refinement of that, which again, probably favorite LG phone of mine.
Yeah, I think it's funny because I carried the V30 for a while too. I actually ended up, that's the one I ended up ruining in Hawaii by taking it in the ocean like an idiot. but I remember feeling a little bit down on the V30 though, by comparison, because when you held the G6, yeah, it might've looked, in photos, it took a lot to make it look interesting. It was pretty dull looking, but when you mm-hmm. held it, those thick side
there
rails and that build. It was, man, that thing was a brick in the best sense of the word, right?
The V30 was so different.
It was so different.
Super
it was so light.
I was so surprised when I held it for the first time. I was like, what is, like, you know, they put this huge battery in here and they have all this tech. How is it this light? And like, I wasn't sure how to feel about it.
Same. Yeah, I went back and forth on it too. And I think ultimately I ended up preferring the G6. And sadly, they went away from that. They leaned harder into that curvaceous, thin mm-hmm. light that apparently every consumer in the world but me wants. But ultimately, it didn't do them any favors. But yeah, that took us into the G7 era, which, sorry, Bader, for the detour.
Yeah,
but
the G7
please.
Was not the phone.
Nope. Yeah, look, I mean, I agree with you. Like there was a heft and a confidence to the G6 that LG never quite regained. Mm-hmm. And I think that came down to the fact that it had so much to make up for, and it really just put its fundamentals first. And I remember people being upset that the G6 only had a Snapdragon 821 versus the 835 inside the Galaxy S8. And how like it just felt like they focused on features rather than specs, but that's what I thought was the right move for LG that year. You know, they focused on making a better camera, they didn't focus really on the specs themselves, but instead on like individual features. And it just felt like a more cohesive, coherent product. And yeah, I liked the V30 because I'm that guy who like is obsessed with listening to high quality music on a phone with you know my expensive headphones. So I like the V line for that. But yeah, I agree. It was a bit of a backward slide. The G7 was, I don't know, it had the boom sound or whatever it's called. Not boom sound, that's HTC.
Whatever that jukebox mode was called.
Yeah.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
higher quality haptics, obviously, which was a thing. And that's become, again, one of those features that LG normalized and now we take for granted. But really, LG did start that trend with higher quality haptics. The quad DAC, but again, like it was nothing special. And then Samsung just started to eat its lunch. I don't know. is there anything else we want to say about these phones? I want to get to the more innovative stuff. Let's talk about the G8X, the Velvet, like the ones that support the dual screen. I know, Michael, you feel very strongly about those decisions. And I think we can end the conversation talking a little bit about, in the last couple of years, LG tried a lot of things that didn't always work, but it left us feeling that like was... there was hope at the very least.
Right. You had the G7 and G8, like the core truth of those units, and then the V40. Like, a lot of people will point out rightly point out the achievements of those devices. The V40 was one of the first, if not the first, to bring us three primary cameras, mm-hmm. right? And the G8, you know, yeah, the spaghetti grabbing claw move that we make fun of Bader for, but like it also gave us
secure
better authentication for exactly right. So the devices themselves are kind of a mixed bag. So, but you got the sense that they were trying to appeal more, trying to compete more with Samsung on a straight on, like, all right, we can make conventional phones too, and maybe people will want to buy these. But at the same time,
just put weird things in them.
Yeah, but at the same time, you had like this other side of the company being like, yes, but also dual screen accessories. And I was like, okay, well, which I don't know how to feel about any of this, because the dual screen stuff was so wonky for so long, it was really hard to get into it. And the most anyone would say, I'd criticize them, and then the most anyone could say in their defense was, look, aren't you happy? They're trying something new. I think this is a good idea. I'm like, yeah, it's a good idea, but its execution is like 75% of what it should be, generation after generation, until we get to the Velvet. So it was a very confusing time in terms of how to feel about this brand. Like, what is its story? What is it?
Yeah. Hayato, you know, I know you've kind of played with a bunch of the more recent LG phones a little. Do you have any lingering thoughts about where things ended?
Not particularly. I mean, I wish I had gotten to play with the Wing at all, because I still haven't even like gotten my hands on that phone at all. But you know, I had the Velvet, I had the V60. I think for me, really the biggest thing that kind of turned me off of those phones was just their size. Like, these are enormous phones, but the actual, you know, functionality of them was about what you would expect from any recent LG phone. The Velvet's cameras were fine. Obviously, the bigger story was with the dual screen. And I don't know. I mean, I think for me, just because I had already spent time with the with Samsung's actual foldable phones, the dual screen never really felt fully baked to me. But also,
yeah.
I think for a lot of people, it's not so much meant to be compared to something like a Z Fold 2. It's more of like, this is half the price of a Z Fold 2 and gives me a lot of the same functionality. And I can respect that, at least.
Agree. I agree. And I want to say that the Wing for me is totally different. I'm not going to talk again for a minute because I've been talking too much, but the Wing is a totally different chapter that I do want to speak on before we get out of this segment, because that's a whole different animal to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go for it.
Okay.
Take us out on a high note.
I used to say when I was acting that it wasn't until a show closed that I could look back at my decisions as an actor and say, oh, well, it's obvious that I should have done that. Why wasn't I doing that the whole time? That's kind of how I feel about the Wing.
That is the most pretentious thing I've ever heard in my life.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll be here all night. And I look back on the Wing now that we know that it's LG's last device. And by the way, going out on that note is awesome.
Yeah.
I'm so glad, because it's almost like we got a little last flash of the old LG, right?
Yeah.
But the Wing appreciated over time for me. It's, you know, like a fine wine, to continue the pretentiousness. I always thought that I when I first saw the Wing, as with a lot of people, I was like, what are you guys doing? You are on acid. And then I used it. And while, again, its execution was not up to snuff, predominantly, I think, because it was a boldly experimental phone. It was very obviously a side project, and they were not going to spend the money they needed or charge the money they needed to charge to actually deliver the experience that it promised. But man, oh man, that form factor makes so much sense, particularly for the year of 2020, when a lot of us are sitting at home. The video consumption is up. multitasking while consuming that video is way up. The amount of hours I've spent literally wandering my apartment watching Pluto TV on the wing, or Netflix on the wing, while also tweeting on the bottom screen, or just propping it up and using it that way. Like, and if that camera had the specs it needed to, and I'm not one to talk about specs, I'm not a pedant in that way, but the camera required a lot more resolution to realize the dream of that gimbal replacement that they wanted to make with it, right? And if it had been so equipped, I would have carried that phone. I mean, that would have been the phone I carried alongside my Fold 2 or something, you know? And that's the greatest tragedy for me. It's LG found itself again in the same moment, in the same instant that it decided, you know what, we're done.
Yeah.
And that makes me very sad.
You know, and I definitely agree, you know, carrying the wing myself as well. I was very much like, okay, I see what you're doing, LG, what you're trying, you know, you're trying to be weird again. And I definitely appreciate that. But, you know, it wasn't until I really got it like in my hand where I was like, okay, I could, you know, it brought back that heft. And I really appreciated that. I mean, it's a heavy phone, you know, you could definitely hurt someone with it, but you know, I thought it made sense for LG to go this way. And, you know, people, you know, I show it off, you know, now, you know, to people, and I'm just like, you know, look what this can do. And they're like, why do you need that? And then I show them, I'm like, you know, you can multitask, you can do all these different things. You can use the bottom, you know, part as like a mouse pad. And they look at me doing these things. They're like, okay, I get it now. You know, and I just wish LG would have just like really had like gotten that first, you know, instead of waiting so long to get to this point. And again, the gimbal thing, you know, because, you know, being somewhat of a videographer, like I was really into the gimbal thing. So I was like, all right, let me try this out. It could have performed a lot better. That was really the only part that I was disappointed with the wing was the gimbal. Because the output was just not great. The regular camera
didn't have the high enough resolution to do it.
Right. The regular camera, the main camera was great. In fact, like to me, that was probably the best camera that LG put on one of its phones. Like I felt like, all right, they actually got it right for once. You know, they actually have a decent night mode. But the gimbal, they kind of messed up there. But as for just the wing itself, like I agree that that's a good place for LG to have kind of left things off. I really wish they would have just like brought back at least one more, like either a V70, you know, because I was really looking forward to that, you know, that velvet design on an actual like flagship phone, or the rollable. The rollable would have been a cool way to go out too, because people are actually looking forward to that. Like, you know, from what we've seen, like, you know, with what little hype LG has given it, you know, there seems to be a lot of hype behind it. So to not get it, it's just so disappointing.
I think that's the biggest shame about LG kind of, you know, stepping out of the field is like the phones that excite us the most that they make are the ones that are the least sustainable from a business perspective, right? Like they can't make enough of these that like people aren't going to buy enough of them to be worth making, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Like it's so experimental. It's so off the wall that, you know, you've got it's a really niche market that you're hitting when you make these kinds of phones, but those are the ones that, you know, are really exciting. They're really fun. And they're the ones that I certainly want to see more of. And I think we're going to see a lot fewer of them now that LG's going away.
Yeah.
And that's that's another bummer just from a strategy perspective. You know, we had not seen LG say with the Explorer series as it did, hey, this is our playground. This is where we're going to go try wonky stuff like the wing and the rollable and whatever was going to come next. And it's starkly, you know, different from our mainline offerings. So to, you know, if that had played out to its logical conclusion, you know, maybe we would have seen with the wing too. Okay, well, we saw again what we saw on the V line. Hey, we listened. Here's what we fixed on the wing. And now we can bring it to market as a great thing. You know, it's like what the G Flex 2 could have been without the silicon issues and the boot loop stuff. Like,
yeah,
there's so many what could have beens with this company, to say nothing of all the various marketing fails that it just always failed to capitalize on its actual differentiators. It's such a shame because now we have to rely on other companies to come in and fill that gap with that boldness, with that willingness to experiment and push the industry along. And LG was, if it was not good at a lot of things, but it was really good at that.
Yep. I think that's a good place to end this segment and just, you know, pour one out for the I was going to say the little OEM that could, but LG was not a little OEM. And like sometimes it felt that way.
Big money.
But reality is that LG is a massive company that makes billions of dollars in profit in other areas, and it's safer selling washing machines and OLED TVs right now than it is smartphones. So I just hope that people at LG in Korea and everywhere else, they are able to land on their feet and there aren't too many layoffs because of this. All right, we'll take a quick break and we'll come back and we'll talk some Google Silicon. AI can do some incredible things, but for most jobs in your company, you need a good old-fashioned carbon-based life form. Yeah, that's a human. Preferably a brilliant one, preferably as soon as possible. If you're looking for great minds that move the world, you can hire them with Indeed. Indeed is the job site that makes hiring as easy as 1, 2, 3. Post, screen, and interview, all on Indeed. Get your quality shortlist of candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your job description faster. Only pay for the candidates that meet must-have qualifications and schedule and complete video interviews in your Indeed dashboard. Indeed makes connecting with and hiring the right talent fast and easy. With tools like Indeed Instant Match giving you quality candidates whose resume on Indeed fits your job description immediately, and Indeed skills tests that on average reduces hiring time by 27%. You can choose from more than 130 skill tests or add your own, then add your must-have requirements so you only pay for the applications that meet them. According to Talent Nest, Indeed delivers 4 times more hires than all other job sites combined. So if you're hiring, you need Indeed. Get started right now with a free $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/ACP. Get a $75 credit at Indeed.com/ACP. Indeed.com/ACP. Offer valid through June 30th. Terms and conditions apply. So I want to spend a few minutes talking about this pretty big bombshell that got dropped by our friends at 9to5 Google, which basically affirmed a rumor that Axios broke in April of 2020, that Google's 2021 Pixel phones, specifically the higher end ones, would be powered by Google Silicon. The code name was Whitechapel. It would be co-developed and built by Samsung SLI on a 5-nanometer process. It would be a 3-cluster chip with 2 Cortex A76 cores, 2 Cortex A78 cores, and 4 Cortex A55 cores, putting it, at least in that current configuration, behind the 2021 flagship SoCs that Qualcomm and even Samsung launched earlier this year with the Snapdragon 888 and Exynos 2100. So just putting out that context is important because we saw the Pixel series in 2020 shifting away from flagship specs, or at least the higher end Qualcomm SoC. Google made some decisions around what it would price its devices at. It's doing better numbers with its A series, obviously, than its like Pixel 5 itself. And now we have reports that the Pixel 6 might actually use this native silicon. And there's a lot of reasons why Google would launch its own silicon, right? It wants more control over the experiences that Pixel users have. It reduces costs. It allows Google to scale a whole bunch of things across product lines. And basically, it allows Google just to have be the owner of its own fate when it comes to mobile devices, even though it will still likely rely on Qualcomm for the cellular side of things. It won't need to rely on Qualcomm for the CPU, GPU, and image signal processing. So all that being said, Hayato, I guess you've been using a Pixel 5 longer than all of us. I think you're using it as your primary phone since it launched in October.
That is correct.
What's your take on this, especially around like Google getting its camera crown back in a way is, I think, the most important goal for the Pixel team this year, right?
Yeah.
And along with a larger sensor and more cameras or just better processing, whatever it entails that this Whitechapel chip will allow, do you think that is what is needed, or is it kind of missing the point?
I mean, I think to some extent it's definitely going to be helpful. This has been a weird year for me with the Pixel because I'm so used to the Pixel always being like, well, this has the best cameras on the market if you can deal with the terrible battery life. And this time around, I've stuck with the Pixel 5 because battery life has been so exceptional. But I just got back from a week in New York, and I was taking a lot of photos with a bunch of different phones for the sake of a comparison article. And looking through a lot of these samples, the Pixel 5 most of the time was not my favorite camera in almost any circumstance. And that's been a really weird sort of change over the last few years for me. So I really, really do hope that they manage to improve the cameras this year. I don't know if, having a new sort of in-house chipset is going to be the end-all be-all solution, but it's, you know, having deeper access to the camera, I think is definitely not going to make it anything, you know, worse. I think especially if we look at how Apple has done with its more recent phones, I mean, these cameras are ridiculously good on the iPhones. I think, you know, partially because it's all so tightly integrated, right? Like Apple just has direct access to every component of its phones. I guess what I'm saying is just, I'm hoping the Pixel 5 or the Pixel 6 ends up taking better photos than the Pixel 5 does.
Yeah. Derek, when you heard this, like, what's your first impression of the news? Do you think that this is Google sort of taking control of its fate, as I mentioned earlier, or is there some other explanation that you had?
I think, you know, when I was looking at this, my first thought was that because Google already has, you know, sort of, you know, some silicon in its Pixel phones already, you know, with the visual core and the neural core. And I feel like Google does a good job. I mean, because Google has, like, you know, they have their hands in AI pretty much everywhere. And that's kind of, you know, what the Pixel cameras are. You know, it's less about the hardware and more about the software. And, you know, even though Hayato was saying that, you know, the images, you know, aren't exactly his favorite coming from the Pixel 5, but I mean, they still take very good photos, you know, compared to a lot of other smartphones with similar hardware. So I feel like Google does a good job, at least at that. And I feel like putting that sort of expertise into their own chip would kind of give the Pixels a bit of an upper hand as far, like, at least in terms of just AI and, you know, not needing, you know, a lot of power to necessarily, you know, use these phones. Because we saw with the, you know, 4A, 5G, and the 5, you know, they're powered by the Qualcomm Snapdragon 765. So they're not flagship chips. They're still powerful, but, you know, that kind of shows that we don't need, you know, these high-end expensive chips to power a Pixel because there's not a lot going on. You know, they're pretty vanilla. Mm-hmm. And so I think Google, you know, recognizes that it doesn't need a Snapdragon 888 level chip in its phones. And so it's probably, you know, that's why we're not seeing the similar cores that we're getting from that. You know, and I think Google's going to lean heavily on AI when it comes to these this chip. And so that might, you know, that might actually be a really compelling thing for the Pixel 6. And I'm not really a Pixel kind of guy. I've never really been into them. But I'm curious to see what Google does with this.
Yeah, I mean, the overarching theme that I heard was that Google wants lower power sensors to enable machine learning and AI processing, including its always-on Google Assistant functionality. Even though Qualcomm, you know, it's shipped its latest SoCs with really low power coprocessors, as Hayato mentioned, battery life is not really an issue for any of the 2020 Pixels. Nonetheless, Google wants to obviously have more. Michel Rahman, the EIC of XDA developers, corroborated 9to5's report and said that the three cluster SoC would also ship with a TPU, or a tensor processing unit, which is a dedicated AI coprocessor that Google has built for its server chips. It's clear that Google is already, as you mentioned, Derek, trying to do a lot with on-device co-processing. It shipped the Pixel Visual Core with the Pixel 2, and then the Pixel 2 and 3. The Pixel 4 had the neural processing unit, which incorporated the visual co-processor and a Titan M security chip. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that this would all just be integrated on die for a much more efficient experience. The other thing that I think is interesting, and here's where I want to bring you in, Michael, is that this will allow Google to unshackle itself from the support contracts with Qualcomm. And one criticism that Google has had levied against it over the last couple of years is that 3 years of support on Android phones is no longer good enough. And that as of December, Google had negotiated an extra year of security patches with Qualcomm. So it will get 3 platform updates and 4 years of security patches. But that still does not reach iPhone levels of updates. And Samsung has now matched Google in for all intents and purposes. So I'm wondering, do you think that is the genesis of this above all of the other benefits, is that they'll finally be able to give Android users 5 years or so of updates?
I want to say that I think that that is unequivocally a good thing, right? I mean, we are, me most of all, but I think all of us in this industry run the risk of dismissing that as, well, whatever, we're covering new stuff all the time and yada yada. But I think at some point, yeah, Android needs to achieve parity with Apple in terms of support. I don't think that length of support, like I would love to see the data that suggests that actual people are like, only 3 years. I mean, I think people are very used to buying phones at least a 2-year interval, if not a 1-year interval now, for better or worse. That's very bad for the planet. It's very bad for people's pocketbooks. I get it. And maybe it'll change over time. But I don't see this as being some kind of magical turning point. My hope for this is if Google does stay with the strategy of building up its own silicon for the Pixels and maybe other phones in the future, that it will just result in some kind of cohesive, recurrent, profitable, good strategy for the Pixel line. Because I'm very tired of the whiplash, frankly. You know, and the Pixel has always been one of the best Android phones you can buy ever since the first generation, problems aside. But it's also never really sold all that well. And to this day, a lot of people still don't know they exist. So it's like, what, you give me a reason where I might someday be excited about the Pixel for normal people out there, then yeah, that's exciting. Until then, I don't know. I don't have any faith in Google to actually follow through on, you know, anything. So
100%.
It's hard for me to, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I see more headlines every week about Google killing something than Google making something. So it's like, what do you want me to, you know? I'm not going to throw any freaking parties.
Sounds about right.
Oh, I mean, you shouldn't be throwing any parties right now anyway, Michael, but I, the point is well taken.
Fair point, yeah. Zoom parties.
So yeah, I mean, all of those points are totally valid. The only thing I'll end with is saying that building SOCs as a sustainable business is really hard. And I think what will end up happening is that if they disclose the relationship, it will be very clear that now that Samsung is no longer building custom ARM cores, part of its ongoing relationship with Google, at least Samsung SLI's partnership with Google, will be around building custom Google silicon, right? It won't be Google necessarily developing its own SOCs from scratch the way that Apple does. It's a partnership that leans on Samsung for the bulk of the design. They're making Exynos chips anyway. And that Google will just be like, here's the architecture, here's the blueprint, go build our custom version of it. That's what I'm hoping for, because then it's much less likely to fail in the long term.
That's a good point. And I will say, on a somewhat more positive note, you know, we were just talking earlier this podcast about a really bad year for Android phones when Qualcomm, frankly, screwed up on the 810 and 808. And it would be nice to have an ecosystem where that is not possible. You know what I mean? It would be nice to have a little bit more of a competitive space where it's like, you know, if one of these silicon makers doesn't have a great year, well, we just don't have to throw away the whole generation of phones, you know?
100%, yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break again. We got 3 ad spots on this podcast because we're popular today, but we will be right back to discuss a little bit more about Google. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by HelloFresh. With HelloFresh, you get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouth-watering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. And that's why it's America's number one meal kit. HelloFresh cuts out stressful meal planning and grocery store trips so you can enjoy cooking and get dinner on the table in about 30 minutes or less. You don't have to be a good cook. Trust me, I'm not. But with HelloFresh, things just seem easier. HelloFresh has a wide variety of easy, delicious options for all 3 meals a day, plus every snack and special treat in between. That's right, treat yourself to some treats with HelloFresh. And it's better value. HelloFresh is 28% cheaper than shopping at your local grocery store and 72% cheaper than a restaurant meal without sacrificing the quality, according to Zagat Dining Survey. Obviously, right now may not be the best time to go to grocery stores, so that's why HelloFresh is an even better deal. I've used HelloFresh a bunch of times with my wife. It is easy. You unpack the ingredients, you see the recipe, you cook them. Honestly, it could not be easier, and I've had a great time doing it. I even bring my wife in, who's not a huge fan of cooking, but it makes the whole experience better. So, if you're interested in trying HelloFresh, go to HelloFresh.com/12ACP and use code 12ACP for 12 free meals, including free shipping. That is HelloFresh.com/12ACP. That's the numbers 12 and then ACP, and use the code 12ACP for free meals, 12 free meals, including free shipping. Thank you so much, HelloFresh, for sponsoring the podcast, and HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. All right, Derek, you broke this news this morning. Google I/O is back after a year off. Google canceled I/O and put out the 10 weeks of Android later last summer. But we will have a virtual Google I/O May 18th to 20th. Everybody's invited. It's free. You don't have to pay. I think this will be really interesting because there will not be a fee. Anybody can attend. They'll be broadcasting the keynote, as they always do, to everybody, but all of the sessions as well will be available for free. It's just going to be a much more accessible event this year. Obviously, fewer parties, but, you know, hopefully that'll come back next year. Google I.O. is my favorite event every year. At least I've been.
Same.
Then I've been since 2012. I've only missed one year when my daughter was born. And it was a bummer to miss it. But yeah, I really do love this event. Yeah, I don't know. It's a shame that it's not being in person, but California's only opening up its economy in July or in June, if all goes well. So it kind of makes sense why it would be virtual again. We're expecting hardware-ish this year. The Pixel 5a will likely be announced at I.O. as the 3a was at I.O. 2019. We're also expecting Android 12's first public beta in May. So it will likely align with the keynote. Anything else? I don't think I missed anything, but am I overlooking anything, Derek?
You know, I'm not sure. And I say that because like I've watched Google I/O, but I've never really been there. I'm not even sure what to expect really from Google I/O besides, you know, maybe a Pixel 5a, which, you know, we've kind of already seen leaked. So, you know, hopefully we'll, you know, see that then or at least sometime soon. A lot of talk about Android 12, you know, the beta, like you said. Hopefully, you know, more phones are getting it. Besides that, I mean, you know, Google likes to hype up their AI a lot, so I don't quite know what to expect.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get those session announcements as we get closer to. Michael Hayato, any thoughts on I/O this year?
I mean, I've got to imagine there will be some kind of Chrome updates for anybody that uses Chrome OS in their daily life. I don't, so honestly, I don't even know what I would expect to change, but I would hope something would happen there, right? I mean...
Well, they just did their 10th anniversary thing.
That's right.
They had a lot of updates for that, and then Android 11 is currently rolling out for Chrome, which, I mean, I think their 10th anniversary stuff was a lot... Like, that update was a lot bigger than Android 11, so...
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I popped open my Pixelbook Go to do some writing, and it was like, hey, you want to update the phone hub and connect your phone? I'm like, oh, yeah. And
it's a thing.
Wow, there's a lot more functionality. That's pretty cool. Yeah.
I think what's interesting about I/O is the keynote always has a ton of moonshots that sometimes don't happen, often don't happen, or get delayed by a year. The really kind of the massive Google Assistant overhaul that we saw, I think it was in 2018, if I'm not mistaken, didn't really get pushed out until the following I/O in earnest. You know, we saw things like Project Mainline get announced 2 years ago. That's actually had a pretty big impact. But Live Caption was announced at I/O 2019. Again, a minor addition, but a significant accessibility improvement to Android that has since been adopted by most phones that have launched with Android 10 and 11. They announced the Nest Hub and Nest Hub Max. Sorry, they announced the Nest Hub Max at I/O 2019. And then we got to play with Stadia for the first time at I/O 2019, which was, again, that it launched in November, but we got to play with the controller. So there's always a lot of really important developer-based announcements at I/O, but they do trickle out and impact the consumer eventually.
Yeah, well, actually, that's a part of the reason I like I/O too. It's not just because it's a big, awesome outdoor event at it with an outdoor press room, and you know you get a lot of sun while you're getting the news. But it's one of the few events left that I attend anyway that normal people hear about and want to talk with me about. You know, I go to back in the day, I would go to 20, 25 phone launches a year, and everyone would be like, oh, where'd you go this weekend? I'm like, the LG V. And they're like, yeah, I don't care. Never mind. But, you know, I'd say like, oh, Google I/O. It's like, oh, wow. Yeah, I heard about that. Is that the thing where they developed a bot where that will kill spam calls, or that'll develop the bot where you can get a haircut appointment without saying anything? I'm like,
Duplex. Like, that was theory. Such a great demo.
I/O always has something like that. Yeah. And it's even if it's a demo that scares people, like there's a lot of that, like, oh my God, Google's getting too big. Let's talk about that. I/O is so satisfying for that reason. It's the one time a year, even Apple events don't do this. People don't even watch the iPhone event anymore unless they're nerds, I think. And it's so enjoyable in that respect. And you're right, moonshots is what it is. So it'll be fun to see that, because that's one of those things that will still survive in a virtual sense. One of the few things that will be just as satisfying in an intellectual way, at least, to see on your computer screen versus sitting there at the amphitheater, you know?
So before we move on, I just want to mention my first I.O. was 2012, which was a big year for I.O. for a couple of reasons. One, back then they were still giving out massive swag bags. So every attendee got a Galaxy Nexus, they got a Nexus Q, and I believe they also got a Nexus 7 tablet. So
why wasn't I doing this earlier?
They were. They stopped in, I think, they stopped when they moved to from the Moscone Center to Mountain View to Shoreline. But 2012 was also the year that they demoed Google Glass by jumping out of a plane and landing on the roof of the Moscone Center with Sergey Brin basically grinning like an idiot the entire time as he awaited everybody to get there. And they pointed these massive antennas to beam the camera feed from the glass down to us in the auditorium to watch this happen. And I was reminded of this because Land of the Giants, it's a Vox podcast, is focusing on Google this season. And the beginning of one of their earliest episodes focused on that experience and how Sergey Brin was just kind of this madman who just wanted Glass so badly that he just took advantage of any opportunity, and I.O. was the perfect place to do it. And anyway, I miss those like super nerdy events where everybody just geeks out over something Google's doing. So hopefully we get that back next year.
Sure hope I ever get to attend a Google I.O.
Ever. Doubt it.
Oh man, I don't feel sorry for you.
Wow, rude.
Yeah, I told you I'd be mean to you in this podcast. It's you had fair warning. And you know why. Yeah. You know why. All right, so we'll gloss over the Google beating Oracle because we're running low on time, but I just want to mention this has been 10 years in the making. Google's appeal to the Supreme Court was accepted. The Supreme Court took up the case in a 6-2 decision. They basically gave Google the win, saying that the 11,500 lines of Java code that Google stole from Oracle amounted to fair use, which is what Google argued from the beginning, and that even though the APIs themselves were proprietary, the actual act of using this code for something else that became Android cannot be considered proprietary, and therefore it fell under fair use. This obviously has implications for how other companies are going to be able to share proprietary information. Jerry has a really good editorial on this. It's called Google's Victory Over Oracle in the Supreme Court is a Win for the Whole Industry. So obviously he thinks that this is a good thing. I highly encourage you to read it because it delves into the nitty gritty of how this is going to make the industry a little bit more sharing friendly at the expense of patents and you know, really closed source code. And it's, you know, I don't understand every bit of the decision, but Jerry breaks it down really nicely. So go read that. We'll put it in the show notes. All right. I want to mention a couple other things. I reviewed the Sonos Roam. That is Sonos's $169 portable Wi-Fi Bluetooth speaker. It's fantastic if you're into Sonos. If you're into Bluetooth speakers, if you leave the house at all, this is a great option. It's a little expensive for what it is, but it sounds really good. It's super portable and durable. And yeah, if you have a Sonos system already, this integrates really, really nicely with it. Finally, the OnePlus Watch, the hands-on embargo. I'm just going to lay it out because this is insane. They had a hands-on and a review embargo. We're not allowed to talk about the review unit at the moment other than the fact that it exists, I guess. Next week, we'll have a review up on the site. Michael, do you have one?
Yeah, we're allowed to say that now?
Yeah, yeah.
Did that first one lift?
As of this morning, we're allowed to talk about it. So You're fine. You just can't say anything beyond you have it. It's a watch. It does watch things.
I have it. It's a watch. It does. It may or may not do watch things. We'll see.
All right. Yeah. So
stay tuned.
I think you can read into that what it is, but it's OnePlus's first smartwatch. It's interesting, if nothing else. So we'll leave it there. We'll talk a bit more about that next week. All right. We're going to take one more break. I'm so sorry. And then we will come back and talk about what's making us happy. And then we will let you get back to your lives. All right. Stay with us. This episode of the Android Central Podcast is brought to you by Ladder. So a few weeks ago, I get a phone call from my wife. She's taking my daughter to daycare and she was in a minor car accident. She's fine. My daughter's fine. The car has been fixed. We're all good. But that moment was absolutely terrifying. The call, I've been in a car accident. I need you to come right now. It leaves you feeling like it's really important to have your ducks in a row to know that if somebody you love leaves you or if you leave them, they have something that can keep them going. So on that note, it makes sense why people get life insurance, especially term coverage, which is surprisingly affordable. So why not pay a bit more each month to protect the ones you love? And if you're asking yourself this question, that's why you should choose Ladder. Ladder makes it impressively fast and easy to get covered. You just need a few minutes and a phone or laptop to apply, and Ladder's smart algorithms work in real time, so you'll find out instantly if you're approved. There's no hidden fees, and you can cancel anytime. And since life insurance costs more as you age, it's probably a good idea to cross it off your list now. So check out Ladder today to see if you're instantly approved. Go to ladderlife.com/ACP. That's LADDER life.com/ACP. ladderlife.com/ACP. All right. Well, we are back. If you're still with us, thank you. We're going to talk about what's making us happy. It's our segment where we talk about something nice in our lives because we all need it. This is a segment I've stolen from one of my favorite podcasts, Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's up to 5 days a week, and I love plugging this show because it's just great. It's Linda Holmes hosted a bunch of other great podcasters. They talk about TV, movies, books, everything pop culture related. And I listen. It's probably the podcast during the pandemic that I listen to more than any other because it's like 15 minutes and it's just about something. So they'll talk about The Falcon and the Winter Soldier for one episode, and then they'll talk about a really good, you know, series of mystery novels or whatever the next episode. So anyway, go listen to it. Hayato, what is making you happy this week?
So this is kind of borrowing on my answer from the last time I was on the show, but I think last time I said that we were going to New York to look at apartments. This time I can say that we got an apartment. We signed the papers and that's all done and over with.
Amazing.
So no more waking up at like 7 in the morning in like a cold sweat of like, oh God, did I get the place? Are they rejecting me? Like, I barely slept at all in the last week just out of stress and anxiety from all that. But now we've got a place, the lease is signed. It's I'm very, very excited and just ready to be done with this whole like preemptive stage.
Man, brush up on your F-bombs and get ready for me to shove pizza in your face. I'm excited.
It's about damn time.
It is.
Hey, man.
It is. I'm very excited. It's, I think we're moving at the right time, too, just because vaccinations are starting to become more widely available both here in Indy and over in New York. Things are starting to reopen. My buddy David Kogan just sent me a thing of my favorite like brunch spot in Brooklyn reopening as of today. So that's... everything is coming together. You know, it's
33.3% of New Yorkers have had at least one vaccine series as of yesterday. So God, you're right. Fantastic. It is a great time for that.
That's fantastic. Yep.
Also, I will shout out David Kogan's new shorts, not the physical shorts on his legs, but his
YouTube. He looks a little confused there.
He is a good looking man, but no, I'm talking about the YouTube shorts that he's been doing. highlighting places in New York that he likes, including his. I think
has he?
Yeah, you should go to his.
Yeah, he just put out a video on
YouTube
Red Hook.
Shorts.
Well, but... it's on his YouTube channel, but anyway. I've enjoyed the one that I've seen. But
The Unlocker.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll link it in the show as well. All right, Derek, what is making you happy this week?
Well, my mother is getting her vaccine today.
Nice.
Yeah, and my little brother, they're starting to put them back in school, like for a couple days out of the week. They both live in San Diego. Where I'm from. So, you know, I'm just glad that my mother is going to, you know, be protected and, you know, hopefully I'll be able to visit her soon and see my little brother as well. And I'm just, you know, I'm just happy for them. Can't wait for, you know, to get the vaccine myself. You know, just sitting here in Seattle waiting, you know, for that eligibility. But yeah, I'm just, you know, happy that my family is being protected.
That's awesome.
Great.
Amen.
That's the right. What's making us happy. I'm glad to hear it. Michael, what is making you happy this week?
Yeah, boy, I can't live up to that, but back to something superficial about content with me. No, I am on my third rewatch of a TV series that is genuinely very dear to my heart. And I highly recommend it to, I think a lot of the audience of this show would appreciate it. It is, in fact,
it
yes.
Is? It
yes.
Is?
It's definitely not. Oh. No, I hate okay. her voice, but oh. she's lovely.
Okay, you got me so excited for it. You don't know how happy I was for like half a second, because that is my favorite show, and it's on
Although
HBO
you and my
Max
mother
right
get
now.
Along. She loves The Nanny
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, it's on
yeah.
HBO Max now, so. okay, all right.
No, my show is a show from a number of years ago called Halt and Catch Fire.
Oh, so good.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. It was an AMC show. It is now on Netflix. Folks, 4 seasons, 10 episodes apiece. It's not a massive time investment. And the great thing about it is I hated it in its first run. I hated that first season.
Yes.
I could not stay with it. I was like, these characters are not very likable. This is dark. This isn't very fun. And then as the show went on, every season is like a different show, but it's all the same characters who you grow to love over the course of it. And by the end of it, you know, and if you need a quick like a slug line, it's like Mad Men, but in the computer revolution, but in Texas in the 80s and then in Silicon Valley in the 90s. But it's really not that. It is very much its own thing. And I will genuinely miss these characters once again. I've just introduced my roommate and friend David Amell to it. My girlfriend Lily, we're all watching it. They're watching it for the first time. I'm watching it for my third. And I can't wait to watch again. I will restart another watch through very soon because it's genuinely one of my favorite TV shows of all time. So highly recommend it. Halt and Catch Fire on Netflix.
At the very least, you've got to stick around until the episode where Fran Drescher makes her cameo appearance. She just lets out her signature
absolutely.
Laugh and just
yes.
walks out on stage.
You're not
That's
lying.
The episode where Niles dies.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, they stuff him into a. They find
just,
him in a computer
now you're just
crate.
Making fun of me. I don't appreciate this.
The Nanny is also a good show. I recommend
Uncle
that.
Uncle Phil shows up and. Gives them a stern talking to.
yeah, Uncle Jesse dies in the same
man.
Episode. It's kind of weird.
Oh, man. Yeah, I love these crossovers, the 90s sitcom crossovers. I live for that stuff. All right, well, mine is also superficial, but it's a bit of fun during a dark time, I guess. I bought the game It Takes Two on PlayStation 5. It's a co-op game where you play a doll version of one half of a failing marriage. So you play either the father or the mother of a daughter who essentially puts a hex on her parents to try to get them to cooperate to fix their marriage. It is a co-op game. You cannot play it by yourself. And I've been playing it through with one of my good friends. It is ridiculously enjoyable. It's a platformer where you literally have to help each other get through the levels. You cannot do it, as I said, independently. It is ridiculous. You battle your long-neglected vacuum cleaner, and then eventually murder it by sucking out its eyes with the tube from the vacuum cleaner. Not a spoiler, but it's very dark. It's very funny. It's a lot of fun. And it's the first like real co-op game that I've played in quite a long time. It's by Hazelight Studios, which made Brothers as well as, what's the other one that they made? A Way Out from 2018. But this is by far their best take on the co-op genre. So it's $40, $45. So it's not a full price PS4, PS5 game, but it's worth the investment. So that's It Takes Two. It's available on Xbox as well and PC, but I've been playing it on PlayStation.
No Switch?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think they have the network infrastructure on the Switch to do. It's also split screen, so it wouldn't really work if you're in portable mode because you cannot play it without seeing the other person's view. So on that tiny 7-inch display, I don't think it would be easy to play, but who knows? Maybe on the Switch Pro when it comes later this year.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
Or Android's Qualcomm
or on Switch. Android. Yeah. Let's hope.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I believe you can play it on Xbox Game Pass. Maybe on Xbox Game Pass, but I'll have to double check that. Anyway, that's what making me happy this week. So that's it. We are half an hour later than I wanted to, but I think it was worth it. Michael,
definitely.
Hayato, Derek, thank you so much. This has been super fun. We love hearing
thank
from you.
You.
So send us an email, podcast@androidcentral.com. Send us your feedback, what you'd like to hear about next time, what you'd like to see change. We're open to criticism. We're especially Hayato. He's very open to criticism.
Always.
Absolutely.
You can find all of us on the Twitters. Mr. Mobile is at the Mr. Mobile. Derek, I don't even know your Twitter account. I'm sorry. You're going to have to plug yourself.
That's fine. It's the Bran Lee.
The Bran Lee. All right, cool. And Hayato is at Hayato Huseman. I am at Journey Dan. We are all at Android Central, except for Mr. Mobile, who is at youtube.com/TheMrMobile. You can find more of his excellent videos there. We'll be back next week with another episode, so stay tuned and thank you. Have a good week. Bye-bye.
Stay mobile, my friends.
Yeet.